Oh, my gosh, I wasn't expecting to hear that tune tonight, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, Willie Nelson here on Coast to Coast AM. But, you know, I picked out a bunch of music. You never know what's going to pop up. And, boy, that one reminds me of my dad. And gosh, it's one of these nights tonight, I guess, huh? 7 years ago on Super Bowl Sunday is when my dad passed. 7 years ago. It's really actually going to be on the 7th this year. But the original year was Super Bowl Sunday. So when everybody talks about Super Bowl, I think of something else. It's not the game that I think about. But that tune right there, can you turn it up just a little louder? That tune, my dad would just sing that. Willie, awesome dude. Just incredible singer. Thank you, Willie Nelson. I got to meet him and interview him before. Great guy, great guy. Well, we're broadcasting live from more than, 620 affiliates or so in North America, including Puerto Rico, Guam, Canada. And you're listening to Coast AM out of the iHeart Studios in Louisville, Kentucky, here at 840 WHAS. We have a great show for you tonight. Coming up, we're going to be talking to a conspiracy guy, author, speaker, and just all around very interesting man with some very juicy, juicy information for us tonight. If you'd like to learn more about him or anything else and all the other previous people or the people we're about to talk to again throughout the week, then go to our website. That's coasttocoastam.com. It's Coast to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis. Our guest tonight is a man that, he's a controversial author, keynote speaker. He has a law background, too. You're going to hear all sorts of interesting things about him tonight. But he's been, I like the way he says this, he's been, you can tell the writer in him, he's been murdering mediocrity since day one. And it's a groundbreaking e-book conspiracy thriller that he's written, that he's put all his knowledge into so that you can kind of read between the lines. It's called The Dreamland Files. The Dreamland Files. His name is Will Champion. You're going to meet him next. He's a Cape Cod transplant to get this to Roswell, New Mexico. And that's where it all started, folks, right? So once in the know of, you know, growing up with Roswell around you all your life, and once in the know that, you know, things really can happen and where you're in a town that absolutely still feared government and dealt with cover-up. And, I mean, think about it. That small town dealt with cover-up, UFOs, aliens, true, false, murder as well. And that's where the conspiracy inside of him started bubbling up. And now he has amazing stories to tell because that's what he just got into, and he went full-fledged into it. He is very interesting to listen to, and you're going to find that out now as well. And he is quite the gentleman, and he is the... I guess the present-day James Bond. At least that's what the book will portray for you. Ladies and gentlemen, our man, Mr. Will Champion. Hi there, Will. Welcome to Coast.
Hello, Connie, and thank you for having me as your guest on Coast to Coast tonight. I'm honored, and you are too kind.
Well, you deserve to be on here. You've got some really great stories to tell, and, you know... people are going to, they're going to know who you are now, that's for sure. Being on Coast, there's no question about that. But you deserve it. You've got a lot of great information. And I've been very particular with Will. Will is very structured. He knows, he structures his, because being a speaker and also being a attorney as well, or, you know, dealing with law along the way. But because of that, you know, I've had to really keep he and I from not talking. It's kind of an interviewer thing. You don't want to talk to people because you want to hear it fresh, and that's what I like to do. So it's been very tough because I've been wanting to know the juicy stuff, but I've been waiting until tonight. So I'm just as excited, Will, to hear this really great stuff. So is there anything else you want to say about yourself before you start telling us, you know, the reasons behind writing the Dreamland Files, or just your life in general, but about the things that you like to talk about and learn about?
Well, for a start, I just want to make it clear I am not an attorney.
No, you, you did law.
I'm versed in law. I was a litigator and my specialty was common law or sovereignty law, and that's a pretty big departure from the mainstream legal system. I was not an insider, and that made things really challenging. It's in the rearview mirror now, thank goodness, and so I get to do all kinds of wonderful stuff, like write and talk and be on shows like this with wonderful hosts like you.
Well, we're interested in your story, and I guess it all started because of growing up in Roswell.
Yes. I would say, yep, that's where it began. And as I was living it, I had no idea. I was a kid. I had no idea what was going to be over the horizon. But you are correct. Roswell, when I was growing up there, was a quiet, peaceful, sleepy at times, little southwest town of about maybe 35,000 or so, pretty nice folks, and a couple of old soreheads. And I loved it. People there worked hard and pretty much played just as hard, and most of us kids knew each other and generally got along. Our main activities after the high school and college football and basketball seasons were over, especially in the spring, consisted of cruising up and down Main Street till well past midnight, pretty much fooling around like typical teenagers did most anywhere else, or maybe driving out to the Bottomless Lake State Park east of town to swim in the deep, salty lakes out there. But there was one thing that set Roswell apart from all the other small towns: the legendary UFO crash the local people knew had occurred in the region in 1947. And Connie, everybody in town knew about it. They weren't stupid. They weren't crazy. And nobody stood to make a dime off of it then. It was probably the best-kept secret in the country, really, until Stanton Friedman and then a number of other UFO researchers started blowing the lid off the story in print in 1992. And I was lucky enough to be there in that town. I lived there. And so I suppose you might as well say that qualifies to be a bona fide Roswellian.
I've never heard of that one. I like that.
So I'm all grown up now. Well, sort of. And tonight I invite you and your listeners to ride shotgun with me on a fascinating journey of mystery, intrigue, and some history that's such a threat to the current world paradigm. It's been erased from the history books, and that, for some of your listeners, will turn your worldview upside down.
Bring it on, baby. We're here for you. We're all ears.
Good. Because along the way, we'll glimpse into our distant past and examine the state of our current affairs from something of a unique perspective to help us arrive at truth and gain a better understanding of ourselves and our place in the universe, and even perhaps help us determine the future we choose to create. And at the journey's end, you may come to question almost everything you've ever been taught to believe in.
Well, I'm with you on that. So how did all this begin? Well, we know how it began with the Roswell. By the way, let me just ask you real quick about Roswell. Did you know the Marcells at all, or did you ever see anything yourself, or did you ever go to the site and see if you could find some sort of artifacts or anything like that? Did you know any really good stuff there?
I was never fortunate enough to know the Marcells personally. I'd heard of them, but unfortunately our paths just didn't cross. I did become acquainted with a few people that were intimately involved with the incident after the fact, of course. One was a gentleman you probably have heard of by the name of Glenn Dennis. He was a mortician involved in the story. I actually worked for a time at the old Roswell Army Air Force base hospital. And a charge nurse I worked under out there was married to a prominent local portrait photographer, and he told us stories about the things that he saw when he was a kid. And yeah, a whole circle of people I became at least marginally acquainted with told me some stories that just seemed at the time too fantastic to be true, and yet they absolutely were. I'm convinced of that in my heart. Now,
so, you know, so before I'm dying to know what the mortician told you.
short version of it.
Okay.
As I understand what Glenn was getting to. Apparently he was working in a local mortuary there at the time that had a contract, with the military to do all of the mortuary work for base personnel. And, one day in early July 1947, he got a strange phone call from a person there, I guess a ranking officer at the Roswell base, and he started asking some strange questions like, how many pediatric-sized caskets can you get, and how quick can you get them? Do they hold liquids? Can they be sealed? So on and so forth. And all of this, you know, for sure piqued Glenn's curiosity. And the man wouldn't answer too many questions on the phone. In fact, he seemed pretty jittery and in a hurry to get off the call. So Glenn drove the mortuary services, I guess a station wagon of some sort, out to the base where he'd been many times before, and walked in through the old emergency room or department entrance around back, where the ambulances and, well, let's call them what they were, hearses, would pull up, and was promptly, well, how do you put it? There was chaos going on, and apparently Glenn was engaged to a young woman there who was an RN, and they were close. But he didn't see her at that instant. He was hoping to, I guess. But there was a lot of frantic scurrying around, and as he started to wander around there, he was confronted by some pretty angry guys with big guns who threatened him and said, "Look, pal, you don't belong here right now. Anything you think you might have seen, you didn't see. And we're going right now." And they escorted him off the base and into town, which had never been done before. And say the least, he was incensed. It wasn't until a couple of days later that he found out what at least part of the story was from his girlfriend. They met at a local tavern. And she was pretty nervous and began telling him that wreckage and bodies and debris had been brought in to the base from someplace north of Roswell, a small village, if you want to call it a village. It's very, very small, called Corona, New Mexico. And there was a couple of apparently live, little beings from another world that match the description of what we now know to be the Grays, or they've been classified as type ones, very small little fellows with tiny thoraxes and long, scrawny, disproportionately long arms and legs, and maybe four digits on each hand, very large heads, large black almond-shaped eyes, the whole bit, and she had no photographs, but she was apparently in the operating suites and when these little beings were brought in. At least one, maybe two, were in her area. It's a little unclear on that, but essentially she began to draw hand-drawn sketches with a pencil on some napkins and showed them to Glenn, and he kept them. And that's where his story began. And over the years, he told me a little bit more about that and other areas too, other parts of the story. It seemed not long afterwards she disappeared, and he was not able to reach her until many, many years later. All records of her even being at the Roswell facility had been wiped clean, and she sent him a letter years later by mail from someplace, I believe, in the United Kingdom. She survived. She was okay, but couldn't have any more part of it. And that was pretty much the end of that, as much as I know. But
wow.
I'm sure, you know, that's from somebody that was, you know, intimately involved in the incident. Maybe he didn't see anything directly, but, you know, I've always known Glenn to be a good man. I don't think there's a mean bone in his body, never has been, and I don't think he would have any reason to deceive, lie, or expand upon the truth. His story has remained consistent over the years.
When he had said, he said at least two bodies that were being looked at, did you ever hear later how many bodies in total, and did you hear if any of them lived? And also, I mean, you know, you got to wonder, when they worked on these bodies, did they really think they were going to be like human and they might be able to help them, or, you know, was that the plan or not, you know? I mean, and if that is the plan, does that mean that they have done something like this before, where they knew how to do it again? You know, was there a protocol?
My guess on that, to best answer your question, is, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think this had happened before. I think this was a totally unprecedented occurrence, and my understanding is the folks out there, the medicos there that received these little critters, were doing what they knew how to do based on their knowledge of human anatomy and physiology to try and save the little guys. I think one may have survived. Because all of these things have been kept shrouded in secrecy for so long and at so many levels, not too much actual fact is really known. However, that's my understanding of it.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to, if you're just tuning in to us, you're listening to Coast AM, and we're talking with Will Champion. He wrote the Dreamland Files, and he has a lot of, he's a conspiracist, and kind of got off on a little bit of the alien thing from Roswell, but he's got a lot more to tell us, and when we come back, we're going to get into that kind of stuff. So thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you're getting a little bit of, I don't know, I guess you're getting ready for the Super Bowl tomorrow too, aren't you? It's a big day tomorrow. It's a big night here, too. Stay with us and learn more with myself, Connie Willis, and Will Champion here on Coast to Coast AM. It's Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. I'm one of the guest hosts on the weekend. Very happy to be here. It's Connie Willis, and along with me is Will Champion, author, speaker, conspiracist. And we were talking about, before we went to break, he was giving us some good stuff about Roswell. Thank you very much, Will. I appreciate that. We kind of went off a little bit. What other things can you tell us that we might not have known about that goes a little deeper when it comes to the terms of Roswell before you move on to, I think we got New World Order stuff coming up.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I would like to touch upon just a few twists about the Roswell incident.
Please.
That just aren't generally known.
Please.
And most people hear about the story, at least in general terms, but there's a lot more to it. They think of it as one single crash, and there probably is a lot more to it than that. Actually, yes, a small flying disc did crash on the Foster Ranch near the village of Corona, New Mexico, and that's about 75 miles or so northwest of Roswell. And that did happen on the 4th of July weekend of 1947, and it was during a pretty violent nighttime thunderstorm. I'm sure that made things interesting. And this craft apparently had been shot down by an experimental jet aircraft from White Sands Proving Ground. Your previous guest, Lynn,
yeah,
might know something about that, being
sure
from
does.
That particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And this craft apparently used an impulse-type weapon that was under development and disabled its electronic controls, and that's what may have caused it to crash. In fact, the dynamics of what I've been able to piece together seem to indicate that, in fact, there were three crafts at altitude, these little spacecrafts. And they may have been involved in a high-altitude mid-air collision, as it were, as a result of this weapon being aimed at them.
Hmm.
It's sort of leaning in that direction anyway. But regardless, a few days later, a second spacecraft, and this one with Delta wings, was shot down on the prairie about 40 miles north of Roswell, and that was discovered, like I said, just a few days later, and a party went out to recover parts and any survivors of that crash from Roswell Army Airfield. Now, a third craft went down in the same region, generally, and same time frame, region being New Mexico, out south on the plains of San Augustine, where, by coincidence, I don't know, the very large array today, that big satellite array, is now located. Which makes you wonder, by the way, if those satellites are purely out there for the purpose of listening to things out in space, or are they transmitting too? Something to think about.
Right, right.
From that crash near Corona, a few live beings, and we've already touched on that, a couple maybe that fit those descriptions of the small gray aliens, were transported along with that wreckage to the hospital at Roswell Army Airfield. And, by the way, at that time, Roswell Army Air Force Base, or airfield, was the home of the most elite airborne unit in the world, the 509th Bombardment Group. And that's the world's first and only airborne bombing unit that was equipped for nuclear weapons delivery. And people that were assigned to that outfit didn't get there for being nitwits.
Right, that was the elite of the elite right there.
Absolutely, Connie. They had to be the brightest, most capable, and most trustworthy of the Army's very best. Now, in Building 84 there, and a B-29 hangar known also as P-3, the wreckage was cataloged and crated. And then the bulk of it was loaded aboard B-29 bombers and flown out to a variety of military installations, Fort Worth and Fort Bliss in Texas, Los Alamos, New Mexico, Fort Riley, Kansas, and Wright Airfield at Dayton, Ohio. A few pieces of the wreckage were recovered by a team led by none other than Major Jesse A. Marcel, and he, as you probably are aware, was the head of intelligence there at RAAF, and this team consisted of Colonel Blanchard and his superior, Brigadier General Roger Ramey, the commanding officer of Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas. Now, these guys handled some of the material the morning of Tuesday, July 8th, which included a control panel imprinted with placements, indentations, for small pilots having six digits in their hands.
Six?
They were also extremely thin, yet incredibly strong sheets of material there, resembling metal foil that really couldn't be damaged by any means, but it unfolded back to its original size and shape without creases when it was crumpled up. Go figure. Plus, there were long structural pieces etched with strange markings that could have been part numbers or who knows, but none of these military officers could identify this stuff. Well, we all have heard pretty much the rest of the story. Colonel Blanchard directed Public Base Information Officer Lieutenant Walter Haught to compose a press release to the local newspapers, the Roswell Daily Record and the Morning Dispatch, and local radio stations KGFL and KSWS. And it was local reporter Frank Joyce's really eloquent voice that announced to the world the Army had finally captured a real flying saucer. And by the way, in Frank Joyce's later years, I spoke with him about this, and apparently he put up with a great deal of ridicule and a lot of pressure after that. And he told me, he said, hey, they used to joke about them being little gray men. They weren't little green men, rather. They weren't green at all. They were gray.
They were gray, yeah. I've heard that one many times. They weren't green.
the famous headline that went around the world through the Roswell Daily Record, you know, Roswell Air Force, you know, captures a flying saucer. All of that went around the world, but General Ramey recanted the story the following morning and claimed that somehow these bright officers, arguably some of the best and the smartest in the country, had all been mistaken and the debris was actually that of, quote, a harmless high-altitude weather balloon, not a grounded flying disc. Okay, everybody now knows that was pretty much a crock. Now, most of the people in the know out there at the time swore an oath of secrecy in the name of national security to never reveal anything about this under the threat of reprisals that, as you said, didn't include the Big M murder. But obviously I was lucky enough to know a few people who did realize the significance of the event and learned about other stuff the government does not want us to know, like the things even I thought only existed in dreams or nightmares. And that's how this incurable conspiracy headache was born. But it would be several more years before I could go deep into the matrix.
And carry on. Lead us into that matrix. I'm dying here. I can't wait to hear this stuff. I'm like, hey, come on, man. I'm dying.
Okay. Well,
and by the way, if you're just tuning in, this is Will Champion. He's talking. You're listening to Coast AM. And Will has written a book called The Dreamland Files. But he's all about conspiracy. He's learned a lot. He's researched a lot. And he's given us the juice now. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No problem. Well, it all began in the year 2001, and that's when, of necessity, though I knew practically nothing at all about law and procedure and court litigation, I had to become a crack shot at American common law. And that's where the real power is. And I had to do it fast. And from the best of the best, I learned to properly apply an extremely aggressive style of case litigation against the opposition. And those are legal battlefield tactics that are most often only known by the highest-ranking judges, which makes that a risky, if not downright dangerous, business. And my courtroom excursions became my crucible. And that's when I began seeing alarming patterns and trends that even in my wildest imagination I could never have dreamed up, but they're absolutely true. And absolutely, as a result, I'm now thoroughly qualified to write and tell about the things that I know, like the big government, dirty and best-kept secrets, and pretty much how it affects us all. Now, Connie, I generally emphasize when I talk to people that there's been a war going on between warlords and serfs for domination, conquest and submission, the ultimate control that's taken literally thousands of years to plan and prosecute. And though that may sound at first preposterous, this war, which is real, it really exists. It's a war of masquerades and high crimes, deceit, betrayals, and swindles of vast fortunes, in which, really, until quite recently, the end seemed very near. A most effective weapon used by these warlords is codified law and its enforcement. And I came to learn that the laws enforced in our court system can be traced all the way back to ancient Mesopotamia, Hammurabi's law code, which deals in large part with contracts, and this law may have extraterrestrial origins. Now, there simply isn't enough time, really, to delve into that now. It is so extensive, but perhaps it's a topic for a future show.
Is this, he's already, look, he's, you give him an inch, he wants a mile. Is this part of where people talk about the war that we're having with ET and human as well? Or are you talking about that too?
Well,
is that separate?
In this context, let's call it what it is. There literally is a war, an adversarial condition that exists between our corporate government, and it is a corporation, registered for profit, by the way, corporation, and it pits the government against the people it was originally set up to protect and to serve and to uphold all of our rights. It is no longer that way. So there's a conflict, a battle going on that people just don't realize is in progress. But this battle isn't happening just today or yesterday or a couple of years ago. It's been developing for centuries and thousands of years before that. But anybody interested in learning all about the codified law and how it affects our everyday lives can find a treasure trove of secret information that's been long suppressed by the world's controlling elite in my little old ebook, The Dreamland Files. But let's have a look at the origins of the New World Order. That will help bring us a little deeper into the matrix for a better understanding, shall we?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're going to go a little bit farther down below the surface now. And let's take a look in our distant past.
You know what? I think it's a good time to go ahead and take the break before you get into it, because I just don't want to stop you. Great stuff here. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Coast AM. My name is Connie Willis, and we're talking with Will Champion. Will is a speaker. He's an author, conspiracist, and just an all-around good guy that will lead you into the matrix of some really interesting things, and he builds up the anticipation and kills you. Great guy. We're going to be hearing more of what he's got to tell us. Looking forward to it. He's telling me he's got some juicy stuff that's not been told yet, and he's already told me some things that haven't that I didn't even know about, even with Roswell. And how many times have we heard that story, right? So more to come here. Stay with us. You're listening to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis, more with Will Champion. And folks, prepare yourself for lots of wings and whatever else you drink and eat on Super Bowl Sunday tomorrow. Big day.